You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wantoku ingoa. E whakarongo ana koe ki te Wire maronga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, tērā rua tekaumārua o here turi kōka. Kia ora, you're tuned into the Thursday Wire on 95BFM for today, July 22nd. My name is Justin and I am joined in the studio with my producer, Connor Het McCarthy. How's the first week back for you?
Yeah, doing good, Justin. Stressed, but great.
The end is near for the week.
Yep, one more day and then the big weekend.
Coming up on the show today, we have our regular update across the ditch with Neighbourhood Watch, aka Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandes. The Olympics are starting tomorrow and International Desk is looking into the Olympians who defected during the games beforehand. Microplastics are everywhere, that's according to a Canterbury University study. The Greens said they want a warrant of fitness for rental homes, and should there be a new approach towards solving the housing crisis? He aha o whakaro, let us know what you think. Tuku pātuki mai, you can text us on 5395, or if you want to talk to us, wai mai rane, our phone number is 309-3879. Our email is, you can also email us if you're tuning in from overseas. The address is studio@95bfm.com. Kaua e waere waere, e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō hei pakihiri rokiroki maranga e te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM ira katikam. You can catch all these stories and the shows beforehand and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. I tēnei wā tonu, now let's head to Tokyo.
Where in the world is Justin Wong? It's Overseas Experience, your international news update on 95BFM.
With the 2020 Olympics officially kicking off tomorrow a year late in Tokyo, here's some related news for you. The Ugandan weightlifter who went missing from his country's Olympic pre-training camp in Japan has been found almost a week later, a couple of days ago. 20-year-old weightlifter Julia Sekitoleko arrived in Japan mid-June before being told he did not make the quota for the Olympics and he was supposed to return to Uganda 2 days ago. Sekitoleko left his hotel in the town of Isu Misano near Osaka last Friday, leaving behind his luggage and a note saying he does not want to return to Uganda and instead wants to work in Japan. Japanese police said Sekitoleko went to the central city of Nagoya by bullet train before travelling to the neighbouring prefecture of Gifu, where he was intercepted by officers. Sekitoleko is already heading back home, while Uganda's Foreign Minister Henry Oyem Okello told Agence France-Presse that his conduct was, quote, unacceptable, and the Ugandan government has apologised to their Japanese counterparts. But this is not the first time that athletes went missing and later claimed asylum at host countries during the Olympic Games. At the 1956 Olympics in Melbourne, almost half of the Hungarian delegation defected to the West after a revolution in Budapest against the Soviet-backed government was crushed militarily by the Soviet Union. And Dr. Johanna Mellis is an associate professor in history at the Maecenas College in Pennsylvania, and I spoke to her about what happened back then earlier today.
My research only focuses on the case in 56 of the Hungarians, although some Romanians did defect at that point. So what happened in 1956 is that Hungary was under communist rule during that time. It was during the Cold War. And about one month before the 1956 Melbourne Olympics were about to begin, so about 30 days-ish before, that was when there was a massive revolution in Hungary in an attempt to either reform or overthrow the communist government, kind of depending on who you're talking to is involved in the revolution. So there's this major revolution against the communists, and there's like bloody fighting in the streets. And as soon as it happened, I mean, athletes kind of were freaking out and for obvious reasons, trying to figure out are they going to the Olympic Games or not. And the team does end up leaving to go to the Olympic Games. And but the revolution was ongoing. And so when the athletes, when the entire Olympic team left for Melbourne, Australia, several of the athletes were already had already realized that they were not going to return to Hungary. You know, they didn't know what life is going to be back with the revolution happening. They didn't know what their what the safety of their families was like. And then they arrive in Melbourne and they don't they didn't find out that the revolution had been brutally crushed by the Soviets. The Soviets had come in with tanks and a crushed revolution, but they didn't know that until they actually got to Melbourne. And so that's when athletes started talking really amongst each other and with coaches and with sport officials from the communist state about what they were going to be doing. And so what happened is about 34 Hungarian athletes and coaches from the Olympic team and four Romanian athletes who lived in Transylvania, which was an area that used to belong to Hungary, so ethnic Hungarians, they all end up defecting to the U.S. specifically. And what happens is that there is a sort of secret operation between the CIA, the American CIA, which is the sort of secret service, and the State Department and Sports Illustrated, and these organizations work together to bring these Olympic athletes to the U.S. and to allow them to pay for them to fly over and for them to sort of work around the asylum rules in the U.S. But without the assistance of the U.S. government through these channels, these athletes would not have been able to do that. Now, there were some athletes who stayed in Australia. There were some athletes who later on went to like West Germany and some other countries. But that is, as far as my understanding, is the biggest case of sort of mass athlete defections from a country as a result of being at the Olympic Games. And that is the thing about the Olympic Games is it provides opportunity for athletes and coaches to leave the country to go somewhere where they can more easily slip out than if they were inside their country, if they were back home.
I'm surprised that the Soviets didn't have any minders like North Korea did for their athletes.
Yeah. So, I mean, so it's different depending on which country. So certainly within like the Soviet Olympic team at the 56 Olympic Games, they decided to not allow their athletes to stay in the Olympic Village. And instead they stayed on a ship. And that was partly because they feared defections and they feared other issues as well. The Hungarian case is different because many of the sport officials who were employed by the communist government, who were members of the Communist Party, they were very sympathetic to the cause of athletes. And actually, the main communist sport official who led the delegation, he claimed in his memoir after the fact that he actually sort of tried to stay in Melbourne. After the Olympic Games, he claimed that he needed a special medical procedure that could only be done in Australia. And the communist government is like, no, you need to come back. You know, you can't stay there. So they're very sympathetic. And actually what my research shows is that because of so many athletes leaving, I mean, there are 34 Hungarian athletes, and then there are hundreds of Hungarian athletes that leave the borders outside the Olympic Games. So it's really this mass exodus, and it actually causes sort of a softening of political repression and policies within the sport community, which actually ends up being really beneficial for athletes in Hungary compared to places like Czechoslovakia, certainly more so than Romania, Albania, and the Soviet Union. So this is where the real specific circumstances of each country really matter. And certainly the North Korean case is very, very different. The Cuban case is very different. And really also just goes to show that there are different kinds of sort of authoritarian governments, different kinds of sort of communist and socialist governments at play here.
Were the Hungarian athletes back then could be seen as a nationalist symbol that could even bolster the 56 revolution?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Yeah, so actually, there's sort of a sort of split memory, I would say, is that the communist government in the decades after, they viewed a lot of these, they simply stopped talking about these athletes and they wiped a lot of them from the records books as a way to kind of pretend as if they didn't exist, right? Because they obviously don't reflect well on the communist state that they defected and never came home. But the memory of the athletes kind of lives on as a little bit of sort of a, I don't want to necessarily say a memory of resistance, but people kind of cling to this memory as like an example in which like people voted with their feet is what historians like to call it, where they said, we're not going to take this anymore. We're going to leave. But certainly after 1989, when the Cold War ended and when communism fell, there was a real kind of resurgence. And this had started earlier in the 80s, but there's a real kind of spike and sort of memory of resistance to communism. And so this case of the Hungarian athletes who defected has kind of, people have seen it as having as being more meaningful now than perhaps it was even then. It's more openly talked about. It's more openly discussed. It is seen and portrayed by some people as sort of anti-communist resistance. And really, the athletes were just looking to get out. They were looking for different opportunities. Not all of them were particularly anti-communist. So a lot of them are really getting a sense of, you know, where can I maybe make better money? Where do I not have as much repression?
So just like this Ugandan weightlifter.
I definitely think so. Actually, that was interesting. Sort of the similarities in terms of athletes feeling like maybe they would have better opportunities elsewhere, which is definitely in the case of this Ugandan weightlifter, where, you know, there's political repression at home, but then there's also real economic crisis in Uganda. And so that is where a place like Japan, which seems a bit more stable, may appear to offer more opportunities for someone like him. And this certainly happens in the Hungarian case. But what happens in the case of in 56 is that a lot of athletes, they come to the US and they realize that the government is not going to support them for being athletes. And so actually a lot of them end up living in poverty. And some of them actually end up going back to Hungary because they want to see family, but also because they want to sort of continue the career, their sport career, and be supported by the state. So it's the sort of thing where like there's an appearance and there's a belief that they may have more opportunities, but it's sort of hard to get a sense of whether those opportunities are going to pan out.
Interesting that you raised that. Some athletes eventually went back to Budapest. How many of them did they, who defected first and eventually returned?
Excellent question. So there are 34 athletes that left, and I can't remember, but it's either 7 or 8 who end up returning home, which is a small number, but I want to say that is still like a quarter or a little bit less than a quarter of the Hungarian athletes who left with the delegation that came to the U.S. There are many more that I haven't been able to account for because their names are not, I haven't been able to find them, but a lot of them, some of them return because they're sort of coerced to return. Some of them return because they miss their families, which is a very legitimate reason. And then some of them kind of end up floundering a little bit in the U.S. because they can't find a job, they can't find a coaching position, or they can't find a position as an athlete. Because in the U.S., you know, in order to actually be an athlete full time and be able to support yourself, you needed to either come from a very wealthy family or be a college athlete, because there was no money for professional athletes to really support themselves by being an athlete. So it's a small number, but I think it's pretty significant that many end up returning.
I think the official IOC position is to not talk about defectors. Are you surprised to see, well, defections at the Olympics not being widely discussed?
I'm not surprised. And that's because, you know, the International Olympic Committee claims that it's apolitical. It claims that it's apolitical, which is a lie, because the entire operation of the IOC is a political foundation in terms of convincing everybody this is the way to compete in sport. These are the uniforms you should wear. All these things are all largely Western white cultural norms. But also it claims that the IOC claims that it does not have a role in commenting on domestic political issues. The thing is, though, that's not the case either. And the 1956 case is an example, because during the revolution, before the Olympic team actually leaves, the IOC is really worried that the Hungarian Olympic team is not going to be able to make it to Melbourne. And so actually there are really important figures within the IOC that essentially contact like the French government and contact like an airline company to ensure that the Olympic Committee can make it to Melbourne. So they are directly intervening in domestic politics to make sure that the Olympic team makes it over there. So I say it's not a surprise because it's not a surprise that they don't directly comment on it, but they do sometimes sort of implement moves behind the scenes to make sure that their version of the Olympic Games actually happens. But again, they maintain this official stance that they're apolitical and that they're not going to comment, for example, on whether Uganda is a good place for an athlete to be or whether it's Japan, right? Because they don't want to upset political leaders. But when it serves their own purposes, they are willing to intervene and kind of do what they want to do.
Overseas Experience with Justin Wong, only on 95 BFM.
And that was Dr. Johanna Mellis speaking to me on International Desk about a history of athletes who defected during the Olympics, which ahead of the Tokyo 2020 Games, which will open tomorrow. E whakarongoana koe ki te irirangi pōho. You tuned into the Thursday Wire with me, Justin Wong, and my producer, Connor Het McCarthy, on 95BFM. Let me know what you think. Tukapatuhi mai. The text number is 5395, or why mai? Call us on 309-3879. It's just past 20 past noon here in Tamaki Makaurau. We will be going on a break. We'll be talking about housing afterwards.
Not all bread is created equal. In fact, some bread is pretty shit.
You might as well be spreading your Marmite on a chocolate bar.
Bread and Butter's sourdough is real bread, using ancient techniques and organic and regeneratively grown ingredients. Choose substance over speed. Choose age and beauty. Check out their online delivery options or head in store for brunch, great coffee and more homemade pastries than you can shake a baguette at.
Bread and Butter, the best sourdough in town.
Breadandbutter.nz.
So, still doing that music thing?
Yeah, I just got nominated for the Silver Scroll.
Couldn't even get nominated for the Gold, eh?
It's a very prestigious award.
Silver. First loser, innit?
The shortlists for the 2021 APRA Silver Scroll Award and 2021 APRA Mile High Award have just been announced. So, if you're an APRA member, now's the time to vote. Plus, voting puts you in the draw to win one of two $500 RockShop vouchers. Vote now at apraamcos.co.nz.
On the prowl for your new friendly local? Look no further than Scarecrow, the cafe with great food and groceries, plentiful vegan fare also, alongside a great buzz. Right beside Albert Park, Scarecrow is located at 33 Victoria Street East. Explore their range of food, which is rated amongst the best in town by Heart of the City. Browse their gifts, local flowers, organic teas and coffees. You can also find them at 811 Mount Eden Road. To learn more, call them on 09377 133 or shop online for Auckland-wide delivery at scarecrow.co.nz.
Gang of Four.
Gang of Four.
Four. Every Friday night, BFM's got you covered for the best tunes to preload to. With a revolving cast of BFM's favourite long-serving selectors, it's the Gang of Four. With Renee Jones, Pat Five, Phil Armstrong and The Professor. Gang of Four. Friday, 7 to 9pm on 95BFM.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and now let's talk about housing.
The housing crisis in New Zealand is a continuing issue that impacts all levels of our society. Last month, a report by UN Rapporteur Leilani Farah announced that housing in New Zealand is a human rights crisis. People in transitional housing have been overstaying government estimates, rent across the country is rising, and there simply are not enough houses being built. Today I tackle two aspects of the housing crisis in New Zealand, the construction of new houses and issues affecting rental properties. I first spoke to Benedict Ferguson, President of the Public Service Association, or the PSA, about their support for a new open letter aimed at Housing Minister Megan Woods. The open letter calls for a new industrial and integrated approach to housing. I first asked Benedict what exactly the open letter was asking of the government.
It's asking for a different approach to, I guess, first of all, is investing and investing heavily in state housing and bringing about an industrial scale state housing building program. we're looking at what's been happening over the last 4 years, and Kāinga Ora is doing some great work, but we think there's a different approach needs to be taken. The number of state houses is pretty much static, so you know, it might go up a few, but it hasn't gone up with what we need. We've got thousands of people on a waiting list for state housing, and we think the idea of industrial scale building programs is a great idea. We're also thinking that the way the government books are looking at the moment, there is this ability to borrow more money while borrowing is relatively cheap to invest in this space. The longer we delay things like this, the cost is going to be moved on to future generations. We know the cost of borrowing is likely to increase, and right now we think it's an opportune time to bring about a bit of a step change in how we do support housing, both in community, the infrastructure, that idea, but it does require a huge investment.
The open letter that PSA is supporting highlights the fact that Māori make up over half the state housing waiting list, while the proposed development will only provide around 1,000 houses to iwi over the next 4 years. What recommendations does PSA have to the government for a more equitable approach?
I'd say engaging with iwi around how you can co-develop things, and that primarily, you know, co-designing and co-governance of iwi-led initiatives would be a good place. It seems, you know, I find it hard to believe that that's the stats that we're showing, that we know Māori are on the lower end of all our sort of stats and that things. And the best way I can say to solve that is letting Māori design things for Māori. So bringing them into the table, working with them, maybe even handing over some of the design and ownership to them, which I know some organisations are doing, but really joining up and working in a much more cooperative way.
Do you have any other comments on government approaches to housing?
I guess it's engaging with those that can do it. We've got 80,000 members in our union who know, you know, they work in these industries, they work for Kāinga Ora, they work for local councils, so we have some knowledge that could be used. We think that there needs to be a much more integrated approach to housing, and that it's not just about housing too. People, you know, talk about we need houses, but we want to build that further. We want houses so that we can build really strong and resilient communities. And that comes along with, you know, infrastructure that's required. So there is not just the houses, but the infrastructure that your local councils provide. And we're pushing a bit further in our union as well. We're saying more public services are needed, and even things like internet becoming a public service. We know that there is a digital divide out there, and we think that an integrated approach to the, I guess, infrastructure, including internet connections, so that everyone has an internet connection in these communities, would really help drive a successful and prosperous community.
What does an integrated or an industrial approach to housing look like?
I guess so industrial scale building, I think that's, you know, you can get scale when you're building en masse. So I know there are pockets of that happening in New Zealand. I'm not sure if Kāinga Ora are looking at that yet, but that idea of maybe it's prefab, but there's other ways of doing it. So that sort of industrial-wide or industrial scale, that would be one thing. And the integrated approach is that it's not just about housing. So what else comes with housing is, you know, safe communities, prosperous communities with, you know, social services, the pools, libraries, public transport, all the infrastructure underground, but creating places for people to live and work. What we don't want is, you know, communities being developed where there's no employment, things like that, or communities being developed where yet your infrastructure will come at a certain time later. It all has to be integrated so that when people move into those homes, they can live a prosperous life, they can work close by, they can engage in their local communities through those social services.
So it's not only about building more housing, it's about developing safe and healthy communities for everyone.
Yeah, it's about that community, I guess the social fabric of New Zealand, that sometimes we forget that when you live in a house, you're part of a community, and that identity to that community and all the things that can bring. And, you know, we want an integrated approach so that we're not seeing some areas get developed more than others, you know, so that everyone can actually live the life that we want them to live in New Zealand.
That was Benedict Ferguson, President of the Public Service Association. After speaking about the construction of new houses with the PSA, I moved on to problems in our rental sector. Across New Zealand, the price of rental properties is continuing to rise, while the responsibility of the upkeep of rentals is often put onto the tenants. Green MP for Auckland Central, Chloe Sawbrick, has a solution. The Green Party have released a petition for a new rental warrant of fitness, a policy that will require landlords to provide healthy, livable homes and protect the tenants. I then covered solutions to the rise of rent. I began the interview by asking what the rental warrant of fitness is.
So a rental warrant of fitness is basically recognising that everybody deserves a warm, safe, dry home regardless of whether they own or rent. But when it comes to a rental warrant of fitness, that is to say that we are going to ensure that those homes are up to standard without people having to fight for it, without renters having to fight for it. So if we were to apply, for example, the 29 criteria that have been outlined by the University of Otago, they would effectively be the healthy home standards with a few additional points added on. Those are running hot water and ensuring that all electrical wiring is in place.
So why is this warrant of fitness necessary right now?
What we've heard from a number of renters, and I can even tell you from the thousands of responses we've had so far since our petition has been up, there are huge problems up and down this country where even though these healthy home standards have been a really important step forward to ensure that everybody supposedly has these rights, the onus or burden of proof basically sits on the renter to take their either property manager or landlord through the tenancy tribunal in order to enforce those rights or enforce those standards. This can be an expensive and time-consuming and potentially ruinous for that relationship between that renter and that landlord or their property manager. It makes far more sense to front-load any of that potential issue and just say we are going to provide effectively a licence or this warrant of fitness up front so that there is no future issues that arise.
Would there be a worry that the costs involved of like a rental warrant of fitness would be passed on to the renters?
Very important to contextualise this in the reality that the average rent, this is across the entire country, it obviously peaks a lot higher in places like Auckland and Wellington, but the average rent for a home is $500 per week in this country. Based on estimates from the University of Otago and from Wellington City Council, who've gone down the track of seeing what this would look like in practice, it would cost between $150 to $250 at maximum, that is half of the average weekly rent, for a warrant of fitness that would last for about 3 years if we were to implement a system like that. I think the other thing to know is that we constantly have landlords and particularly property investors associations threatening that rents are going to go up. And I have not found one landlord yet who is able to guarantee me that if a warrant of fitness was not to be brought in, that they would not increase rents. We had, for example, over the past 12 months, a situation where even though we had that 6-month rent freeze during the COVID lockdowns, we had a situation of the most fortuitous circumstances financially for landlords who held mortgages in generations. Those are incredibly low interest rates, but we also saw landlords continuing to increase rents. So you can't say that these two things are connected. It definitely is the case that landlords pass on costs, but we've also seen that rents have increased far beyond that passing on of costs. Just to reflect on some research that was released about a day or two ago by a data analysis published in the spin-off, we can see from 1993 that house prices, or rather rents, in and of themselves have effectively doubled, even when adjusted for inflation. But the quality of the housing stock has stayed effectively the same in the past 20 plus years.
With the increase in rent, are there any solutions that the Green Party has to sort of impact that in a way that it could be more equitable for renters?
Great question. We are also campaigning on rent controls. And this is something which I think has been really fascinating to watch play out in the political or parliamentary context, because I, for example, have put questions to Portal Williams, the Associate Minister for Housing, who has responsibility for areas like this. who has not said that the government is ruling it out, which, as you'll know, is relatively rare with this government, with this Labor kind of led government. And I have also challenged them on the fact that they provided a rental freeze during COVID-19 lockdowns over the last year, and that has had a massive impact with regard to the figures that they continue to quote about how rental increases were less last year than they have been in other comparable years. So the models that we're looking at here, and there's about 9 different proposals that you'll find on the Greens website. If you just Google rental controls and the Greens, you'll find them. And they kind of vary from a San Francisco type of approach where there are criteria that are imposed either at a local government or national level where you could say rents, you need to have X, Y, Z, and here are different criteria to figure out what the calculation would be of the rent. We could alternatively have a Swiss type of model, which I think is the one that most people I've spoken to have erred towards, where you have kind of a union for renters and you have a association or body of landlords. Both of those groups have representatives who once a year come together and negotiate the average rental increase for the people who are implicated in those properties, which is about 500,000 people in Switzerland. So that's a model which also looks really beneficial. And I think that that's another really important thing to continue putting on the table here, is that there is not one silver bullet to solve the rental crisis, to solve the housing crisis in this country. But the Greens are really clear that we need to move away from a system that commodifies something that is literally recognised as a human right by the United Nations, to which New Zealand is a signatory of.
That was Chloe Swarbrick, Green MP for Auckland Central. And before that was Benedict Ferguson, President of the Public Service Association.
Thanks very much, Connor. Someone texted in saying commercial buildings are required to have building warrant of fitnesses, so why not residential where the building is rented to a third party? Keep your texts coming in. Our text line is 5395, or if you prefer calling us, the number is 309-3879. Now let's head over the ditch to Adelaide.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week on Neighbourhood Watch, South Australia is plunged into its second lockdown after the state's current COVID-19 cluster continues to grow, with 6 new cases confirmed yesterday afternoon. Out of the 6 new cases, 5 contracted COVID-19 after visiting a winery north of Adelaide, which was visited by someone with the virus on Sunday, while the 6th case was a young child who visited a Greek restaurant in Adelaide CBD the same time as another positive case. And I spoke to Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandis this morning.
In lockdown, a very interesting path my life has taken since I spoke to you last. Not necessarily expecting it, but who is? So yeah, we've gone down into lockdown from 6 p.m. on Tuesday night. This is obviously because South Australia has acquired some new community COVID cases, and we got some confirmation yesterday that this is the Delta strand of the virus in South Australia. So some really terrifying and awful news for the state. We've gone into lockdown. Only essential workers can work, and you can't go outside your house unless it's for compassionate care reasons, buying groceries, exercise, and a couple of other things that you can do as well if you need to. It feels awful and scary. That's just my personal opinion of the situation. But we're also seeing states like New South Wales, who have had 110 new cases, you know, in New South Wales yesterday, I believe that was. So all around the country, we're seeing, I think, 3 states into full-on lockdown. So it's all happening again. Obviously, we can sort of put this all back onto our federal government and the fact that none of us are actually really vaccinated speaks a lot to our current situation. The fact that, you know, we're back in lockdown and the rest of the world, not that we think the UK should be out of lockdown, but, you know, we're looking at the rest of the world now and everyone's going back to normality and we're sitting here not able to leave our houses.
The cases, all six of the cases are connected to New South Wales?
Yeah, I believe so. I'm really bad, everyone, at sort of tracing back cases and knowing where they started. But yeah, I believe that they were traced back to New South Wales, and then they came here and went to a Greek restaurant and a few other places, and now we are in lockdown. And that's not me trying to, demonise the person who had COVID. I mean, none of us want it to be us, and they obviously didn't know that they had COVID when they went to all those places.
And when it comes to essential workers, I assume that Radio Adelaide is also classified as essential?
Yes, yeah. So I'm here at Radio Adelaide right now, actually, just presenting about to present their breakfast show. So, yeah, we're essential workers. My other job is a bank job and I work from home, so that's really good. We're seeing... So when I, last night my friend's like, I'm ordering a pizza, and I was like, what do you mean you're ordering a pizza? We're in lockdown. You can't order a pizza in lockdown. But you can. So this time around, we're seeing a few places open, like even a couple of coffee shops are open, because I think the government sort of made the decision that like we can't actually really expect all these small businesses to lock down again and not get any income. And can the government really afford to now keep paying all these businesses and all their employees to be able to lock down? Like, I just don't think that that's possible at this stage. So, yeah, I was a bit surprised. There are a few like coffee shops open and a few takeaway joints open. A handful, like, and then also a handful have decided to shut as well, which is totally fine. It's an interesting time. We had six new cases yesterday. We won't have another presser for another few hours, so I don't know what today will look like. But that's just where we're at. I sound so defeated, don't I? I'm just like, ugh. I know. I'm sorry. I'm not presenting this very well, but like, I just feel quite defeated, to be honest.
Does it feel different to the previous lockdown?
No, a little bit. Like, as I said, like, there's a few places that are open that I'm like, why are you open? But, like, I guess you are, a struggling business. That's probably why you're open. But it doesn't necessarily, like, the city streets are still dead quiet. Roads dead quiet. You can't really go anywhere without seeing no one. So it does, it's like where South Australia is doing the right thing, and it's really nice. So, we're always pretty good here. We're locking down and getting it done. So it doesn't feel too different, except for the fact that a few businesses that I thought would be shut and not essential are open. That's about it.
Right. But what about the other states? Now, I assume that Western Australia has already shut its borders from the west of the country, right?
Yeah, certainly. I think a few places were allowing for, like, six, like this morning, if you're coming from Australia to, like, Queensland, for example, I think the shut-off time was this morning, and that makes sense because it just takes so long to get to Queensland. Like, Australia is this massive country that you can't expect someone to get across certain borders within, 8 hours. It's just unrealistic. Most of the country have locked off all their borders again. To each other, and yeah, Western Australia is still trying to preserve itself a little bit there, which is fair enough. If you were to return to Western Australia from South Australia, you would have to do a 14-day lockdown and things like that.
So, and I can also assume that South Australia is shut off from the rest of the country?
Yeah, certainly. No one wants us in. And we don't really want anyone else in either, but obviously if you were to live in South Australia, you're about to come home.
And the lockdown will last till next Tuesday?
Next Tuesday, but, like, no one's saying that out loud because no one wants to jinx it. You know what I mean? Like, we're just like, yep, like, let's just, it's going to be Tuesday, but no one say it, otherwise we'll jinx it, and then we'll be in this for another 5 years. So, next Tuesday is when, at 6 p.m, we're expected to come out of lockdown, and everything will be fine again, you know?
And, before the lockdown, were any, like, mask mandates in place?
Yeah, before the lockdown on Thursday or Friday, like, I went to a gig on Friday night, and we weren't allowed to dance or sing, and we also had limited capacity, so things like that were in place by the weekend and on Friday. Mask wearing, however, at this gig, for example, wasn't mandatory. The football went on at full capacity at Adelaide Oval. It was a Crows game. At Adelaide Oval, you have to wear a mask when you are not at your seat in the stadium. But when you're in your seat at the stadium, I believe you can take your mask off. I'm not sure if it was different over the weekend and everyone was sitting there with masks on. But anyway, an Adelaide Crows game went on at full capacity. So, I could talk all day about the disparity between the arts and sport here, and I'm sure it's similar all around the world. But, there were a few restrictions in place. So you could sort of feel it brewing, but I wasn't expecting a 7-day full-on lockdown. But, hey, there you go.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was indeed Radio Adelaide in Neighbourhood Watch. And the time is just after 12:45. We will be at another break.
Swap the hard stuff for mental clarity and performance this dry July with Arepa, New Zealand's number one brain drink. Caffeine-free, plant-based and clinically tested, Arepa is proven by neuroscience to keep you calm and thinking clear when you need it most. Arepa, 100% natural, effects you can feel. The world's smartest brain food. Found in all good supermarkets or buy online at drinkarepa.com.
Morning people are celebrating their 5th birthday with the mother of all pre-Meridian parties. With performances from We're Together Live and Sam Bora from Shapeshifter, we just know you want to be there. So, V-card holders, keep your radio tuned to 95 BFM and you could be it to win a couple of hot little tickets. Morning People's 5th birthday, 7 a.m. Saturday, July 24th at the Auckland Town Hall. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
Don't stop when your period starts. The Lunette Menstrual Cup is the easy, hygienic, reusable alternative to pads and tampons.
Convenient and comfortable, it's made from 100% hypoallergenic medical silicon. Lunette is safe, smooth and sustainable.
Great for you, great for the planet, great for your wallet. Live life to the fullest, all month, every month, with the Lunette Menstrual Cup. All it takes is the first step. Go to lunette.co.nz. That's lunette.co.nz.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. And finally for today, we are talking about microplastics.
New Zealand environments are filled with tiny, near-invisible plastic particles known as microplastics, according to new research out of the University of Canterbury. Microplastic researchers Professor Sally Gore and Dr. Laura Revel of the University of Canterbury are currently undertaking research into these microplastics in our environments. The aims of the research are to understand the wider impacts of these particles that will have on our natural wildlife, human life, and environmental bodies. I spoke to environmental chemistry Professor Sally Gore about these microplastics within our environment. In our interview, I asked what the dangers of microplastic could be, where they are present, and what solutions there are to stop microplastics entering our environment. I began by asking Sally about what her research covers.
So the focus of the research that we're doing here at the University of Canterbury is trying to understand sort of where microplastics come from, what kind of microplastics do we have in New Zealand, and what might be some of the implications of those microplastics. Where do they go? What do they do? What kind of effects might they have?
What are microplastics?
So microplastics are small plastic particles, less than 5 millimetres is the usual working definition. Now, these can either be deliberately produced, something like the beads that were in facial scrubs, or might be used for blasting or glitter, one of my pet peeves, or they are made from the breakdown of bigger plastic items in the environment.
And why are microplastics dangerous to our environments?
They're ubiquitous, which means we find them everywhere. They are very small, so they're quite mobile. Once they're out in the environment, they're going to be very, very hard to remove, if not impossible to remove. And not only do you have the plastics themselves, which can have adverse impacts on organisms, they may also have adverse impacts on humans as well, but the jury's still out on that, and the science isn't fully sorted around that, is not only do the other plastics themselves a problem, but when the plastics are made, they use catalysts. Something like antimony is used as a catalyst to make polyester, which is in our clothing, or they may have additives, colouring, to give different chemicals added to either in the manufacture to give them properties. They can also pick up other contaminants from the environment. So wherever those plastics go, those contaminants that are associated with them go as well.
Are there any specific environments that are most vulnerable to microplastics?
I don't think we have enough science to say that, but anywhere that anybody has looked, from up on the top of Mount Everest to deep sea trenches, everywhere people have looked on Earth, they have found microplastics.
And have you identified any solutions to stop microplastics entering our environments or to sort of remove them from the environments once they're there?
So people are looking at how you might remove them, but I think stopping them entering the environment is going to be the biggest. And that's going to involve people sort of reevaluating our love affair with synthetic polymers. So we're going to have to think about, when do we use them? What's a good use of plastic? What's not a good use of plastic? And we're going to have to get better when we have finished using a plastic item of reusing it, repurposing it, recycling it, rather than having them released into the environment.
And what progress have you made with your research so far into looking into these microplastics?
I'm involved in several research projects with different external parties as well. We have identified that plastics are present in Laura's work, identifying them in the atmosphere. We've identified them in wastewater. We've identified them in seafood. We've identified them in beach sand. They're present in our waterways. We know that they are widely present. The next stages that we're looking at is starting to look at some of the impacts on toxicity, what they might do. Particularly, we've been working with bivalves, so we know they're present in mussels. We've got projects that are going to look at what happens to mussels. We are also starting to get interested in what happens, particularly around clothing, and what kind of chemicals are in the plastics, and what might be being carried into the environment.
And so finally, what can people be doing to sort of try and reduce the amount of microplastics that they are contributing to our environments?
For every plastic item you think that you use, think about whether you need to use it. So we are starting to phase out single-use plastic items, but each one of us is going to need to think about, with plastic items, do we need it? Is this a good use of plastic?
That was environmental chemistry professor Sally Gore of the University of Canterbury on microplastics in our environments.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hotaka mo tēnei rā, and that's all for the Thursday Wire for today, July 22nd. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero me kia mātou mō tēnei rā. Thanks to those who spoke to us today. We got Radio Adelaide, Zoe Canandes, Screen MP, Auckland Central MP, Chloe Swarbrick, Dr. Johanna Mellis from Messinus College, Benedict Ferguson, the President of the Public Services Association, and Professor Sally Gore from the University of Canterbury. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rawiki. We will be back next week. Also, big thanks to my producer, Connor Hepp-McCarthy, today. I'm handing you over to Sigrid for the next 3 hours from the 1 to 4. E whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi poho, you tuned into 95BFM. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card.
go to 95bfm.com/signup.